This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Paula Swedeen, Forest Policy Specialist for the Washington Environmental Council, and Joe Kane, Executive Director of the Nisqually Land Trust. Paula and Joe are here today to tell us about forest protection in Washington State and the Nisqually Community Forest. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Would you like to begin by telling us about the Washington Environmental Council and the Nisqually Land Trust?
The Washington Environmental Council is a venerable organization in Washington State. We have been around since the late 1960s and have worked on a variety of environmental issues that are important to the people of the state. But Washington Environmental Council has been working on forest and forest protection issues for most of that time and have been involved in creating and improving our state's forest practices regulations. And in recent years, we have come to realize that our regulatory environment provides a very good foundation for forest protection on private lands. However, there's a lot more that can be done in our forested environment. So we have been more recently looking to an incentives type program and ways to advance forest protection beyond just using regulations.
So Joe, would you now like to speak about the Nisqually Land Trust?
Nisqually Land Trust is a 501c3 nonprofit, a land conservancy. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary. We were founded in 1989, and we work in the Nisqually watershed, so from Mount Rainier National Park down to the Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge. What we do mainly is we acquire habitat, specifically for threatened species such as Chinook salmon and steelhead trout and marbled murrelets and northern spotted owls. We started out really around the salmon issue. We work very closely with the Nisqually Indian Tribe, which is the lead entity for salmon recovery in our watershed. And for our first 15 years, we concentrated on protecting salmon habitat on the Nisqually River. And we've done a good job of that. And we use Big We, a highly cooperative and collaborative watershed. No deep pockets in the watershed, but lots of people with good intentions. And we've protected now about 78% of the main stem, Nisqually River, which is a lot. Over the last 10 years, we've started to move into what we call the upper watershed, which is really the timbered, commercial timber zone, because we realized that for all the work we're doing to protect salmon habitat down below, unless we can influence how trees are managed, how forests are managed across a very large landscape, the work we're doing on the salmon habitat's not going to be enough. There's so much influence coming down from the mountains in terms of rainfall, soil runoff, water temperature, things like that, that we have to start to change the way we look at that landscape.
Well, you've already started alluding to this, but why is it important to protect Washington State's forests?
I can speak from our very local perspective. Our forests do a lot of work around conservation issues. They are absolutely critical to survival of species like Chinook salmon, steelhead trout, northern spotted owls, marbled murrelets, and many, many others. We have some of the best timber-growing land in the world in the west slope of the Cascades. We have in the Nisqually watershed, in what we call the upper watershed, the upper half of the watershed, something close to 100,000 acres of privately owned commercial forest. The nature of that land ownership has changed over the last 10 years as global economies have emerged. Land ownership in Washington State in terms of commercial timber now is mostly globalized, which is a change that I think a lot of people are only just now beginning to understand has happened. So the ownership of our forests is incrementally, in large increments, sort of been removed from local involvement. The commercial timberlands in our watershed are owned by investment groups on the East Coast who manage those timberlands for investors around the world. For us, that has changed the way those forests are integrated with our local needs. So we're looking at ways, can we relocalize some of that ownership so that our forests are more closely aligned with the needs of our communities, of our species, of our wildlife, of our habitat?
So from a statewide perspective, I want to start answering this question by making the distinction between lands that are owned and managed by the federal government, so Forest Service and Park Service land for the most part. And there have been lots of groups over the years who have worked on protecting those forests. And since about the early to mid-1990s, the heyday of old-growth logging ended, and we've entered into a period of restoration and protection of remaining old forest habitats. And so WEC has, for the most part, been focusing on forest lands that are owned and managed by private landowners and the state of Washington. And that chunk of forest serves, as Joe said, they work very hard for the benefits of the people of Washington. So in addition to providing forest products and employment, Those forests are also very, very important for climate stabilization, for sequestering carbon. We have some of the most, on a per acre basis, productive forests in terms of holding carbon and keeping it out of the atmosphere. Our forests, especially in the managed landscape, are really important for water quality and also for maintenance of flows. And by that, I mean in the summertime, we tend to have sort of a natural dry period. But over the years, our streams have gained water deficits, which make it hard for growing communities in the lower parts of the watershed to have adequate water. And then in the wintertime, we see more peak storm flows, which leads to flooding and it leads to landslides and it leads to lots of debris and scouring out of the streams, which is bad for salmon habitat. So by protecting the forests, and for the most part, when I say that, I mean trying to maintain more mature forest cover. And WEC's vision is to eventually take a portion of our private ownership and transition it back to longer rotations. And by rotation, I mean the length of time between a cutting cycle. And so a typical cutting cycle on industrial forest land right now is anywhere between 30 and 40 years old. It used to be, say, between 50 and 60. And those shorter cutting cycles don't optimize carbon sequestration. They certainly don't provide any habitat for some of these species that need large, structurally complex forests and trees. And for that, you need more like 80 to 90 year rotations. And then we also think there's the science to show that there are some water quality and quantity issues with short rotation forestry.
How well overall are Washington State forests currently being managed?
I can only speak to our watershed, and it's relative. I think you have to speak in terms of both the absolute, what we would love to see is the ideal management system, and how forests are managed in other places. Washington State has a reputation for having, compared to other parts of the country, some fairly strict forest regulations. That said, we think the jury is still out on whether the regulations are having all of the impacts that they were set up to have. We can see in our watershed some places where the regulations, even though the timber companies we work with, they follow the rules. They're not robber barons. They're not doing stuff in the dark of night or anything like that. And we work with them very closely. But we are starting to see places where we think the regulations aren't strong enough for the conditions that exist, where we have very steep slopes, unstable soils in very sensitive areas.
Well, for full disclosure, first, I would like to state that I serve on the state's Forest Practices Board, which is the entity that develops and oversees the implementation of regulations. And I would say that we have one of the best regulatory programs in the country. And we have kind of a unique setup where private landowners, timber companies, tribes, environmental groups, and state and federal agencies work very closely together to make sure that these rules are following the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. And then also by law, our rules need to ensure a viable timber industry. And nobody would deny that that's a difficult balancing act. And, you know, my sense from sitting on that board is that people try very hard to do the best they can. And I do think that we have a good set of rules. But I also think that the times demand a really big picture look. And again, that's why Washington Environmental Council is looking into incentive programs and ways to really fundamentally change the economic drivers. Because right now, forest landowners get compensated for timber products, for timber land sales, like some of these timber investment management organizations, or for converting to real estate. And those things tend to underproduce. If you're going to speak as an economist, they underproduce public goods, such as habitat and carbon sequestration and clean water. So if you want to keep landowners on the land and provide them sort of just compensation, you can't just expect them to all of a sudden stop harvesting timber, nor can you expect them to not take advantage of financial opportunities that are perfectly legal for them. However, if we can figure out ways to essentially make the trees more valuable standing than cut down. And I'm not talking about ending harvest or not having a wood products industry, but slowly transitioning back to a place where we have higher timber stocking on a per acre basis. And that's what a longer rotation does. So you actually, once you're equalized in a landscape, say on an 80-year rotation, you've got more board feet to the acre available for timber harvest, in addition to having a landscape that's got more habitat for species that require older forests, more carbon per acre, and like I said, better water quality. So while from a regulatory perspective, I think Washington's lands are being managed just fine, we can do a lot more.
And I think what Paul was just talking about really strikes at the heart of why we came up with this community forest concept. As a land conservancy, we buy habitat. That's principally what we do. And we have no powers of condemnation. We can only operate with happy sellers. You know, we raise the money, and if somebody wants to sell property to us, and it's property that's strategic, we'll buy it. to change the way commercial forestry is happening and to change it at the scale and at the pace that we think it needs to change. In our watershed, we're down with the steelhead trout, we're down to maybe 250 spawning adults left. So we can't wait 10 years for regulatory transformation. We need to find the money and go in and buy these properties from the current landowners at a market price that works for them, and then on our own, figure out ways to both manage for conservation and for commercial timber production. We think we have some advantages in that we won't need to generate quite the profit that a commercial operation does. We wouldn't have underlying investors that had to be paid at a high rate. There's some other advantages like that, but that's kind of the model we're looking at.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Paula Swedeen, Forest Policy Specialist for the Washington Environmental Council, and Joe Kane, Executive Director of the Nisqually Land Trust. Our topic is forest protection in Washington State and the Nisqually Community Forest, and you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Let's now focus in on the Nisqually Community Forest. Would you say more about the Nisqually watershed and why it's special?
Well, it'll be my parochial view, of course, not to dwell on myself, but in previous life, I spent a lot of time working in the Amazon River and was on an expedition, made the first source to see navigation of the river, and I wrote about it. So I saw the biggest watershed in the world, top to bottom. And then I wound up here in the Northwest, and to be able to be in the Nisqually watershed, which of course is a much smaller watershed, as we like to say, small watershed with big ideas, and to be able to work in that landscape and to see the work that I do and all of our many partners and actually see the impact, as we say, we can put a quarter in at the top and watch a gumball come out at the bottom. That makes the Nisqually very special. Given that it's located between two metropolitan areas, Tacoma and Olympia, it is an unbelievably shallowly developed landscape, shall we say. We certainly have real estate development, but a lot of the watershed is not very developed. A lot of our habitat is in pretty good shape. So it makes it fun to work there. We still have a lot of wildlife. And we work with a tribe, Nisqually Indian Tribe, it's our major partner. I really consider it a matter of great good luck for me to be able to work with an Indian tribe. There's just something very special about that. And we have a highly cooperative watershed. The Bolt decision, which many people will be familiar with, that grew out of the Nisqually watershed. And the Nisqually was the forefront for the salmon wars 25, 30 years ago. And we've now evolved into an international model for cooperative conservation. We have delegations come from all over the world to see how we do things. That makes it very special. And plus, Mount Rainier's at the top, Puget Sound and the Delta's at the bottom. It's a lucky place to be.
Before we talk about your specific community forest, what are community forests and what is their history?
In general, community forests are a flexible model, and the ownership can be in a variety of forms. But in general, community forests are where people in the local area get together and exert a direct influence on how the forests in their area are managed. And that influence is for the benefit of the entire community. So the most common model is that some ownership entity is formed from members of the community, and they get together and they purchase, you know, maybe it's a few hundred acres or maybe it's a few thousand acres, and they get together, they purchase the forest, they form a management board, and they make decisions either directly in consultation with local community members or with the community interests in mind. And the goals are often to protect the scenic values, to protect local access for traditional hunting and fishing and recreation. A lot of times there is a habitat protection component, and also quite often there's local employment. So from wood products and or from gathering non-timber harvest products in the area. Community forests have a pretty long tradition in the northeastern part of the country. In fact, one of the, if not the largest community forest in the country is in Maine, and it's a place that our community forest team went to visit to learn. It's called the Downeast Lakes Community Forest, and it's run by a local land trust there. And it was formed in order to prevent a proliferation of second home development and also an ownership change in which the new owners, which were a timber investment management organization, would have excluded a lot of the traditional community access.
I don't think most people know this story, and I think it's true, is that, as Paula said, community forests are an old tradition in the Northeast. And Henry David Thoreau, when he was on Walden Pond, was actually in a kind of exile because he had burned down the Concord community forest a couple of years earlier. And there's a passage, I think, Simon Walden is one of his other writings, where he goes back to look at it a couple of years later, and he said, well, it doesn't look any worse than if it had been struck by lightning. But we don't have that tradition in the Northwest, and we have a different set of circumstances. In the Northeast, you don't see a lot of public land, as opposed to what we have out West. We do have big public lands. And we also have a scale here. When we went to visit the community forest in Maine, it was a great project. It was big. It was 50,000 acres. But they said, hey, we're going to take you up to the old growth section. We found ourselves walking, you know, through these saplings and stuff, and we said, where's the old growth? And they said, well, you're in it. And we said, whoa, that's not what we call old growth. We have a bigger scale and a bigger challenge here and a different model. We're working on it in the Nisqually. We have groups all over Oregon and Washington, all working toward creation of a community forest. Everybody's got a slightly different approach. We have come together. We had a big meeting last year to compare ideas, trade ideas. Everybody knows this is coming. We're just learning how to put the pieces together on it. For us, we have incorporated. We started with a watershed-wide discussion in the Nisqually about what would a community forest be? What would it look like? We convened an advisory group. We formed a core planning team facilitated by the National Park Service, by Mount Rainier National Park. And then we formed a 26-member advisory group of stakeholders. And over the course of 2 years, we met, we discussed, we brought in experts from outside to say, here's how you finance these things, here's what you might want to consider in terms of land management, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of that process, came out with a recommendation to form a kind of ownership entity. We incorporated that ownership entity last summer. Paul and I are both on the board of the new Nisqually Community Forest. We'll be having our first retreat next week. You start to really get down in the weeds on it. How do you fund it? You know, how do you operate at a commercial level? And for us, we have to use the advantages we have as a nonprofit, which is how we're incorporated, which means there's certain kinds of conservation funding available. But we also have to learn how to operate in a commercial way as well, because you can't raise enough conservation money to work at the scale that we need to work to really affect habitat in the way we need to affect it. If you're going to do a 20,000 or 30,000 acre project, you are going to have some conservation money there, but you're going to need to be in the commercial timber market as well. So how do we learn to do that as a community in a world that is highly competitive, where there's big demand? You know, a lot of our West Slope timber here is going to Asia and will continue to go to Asia. There will be that demand there. We're playing at a very high level game.
Would you underscore the goals of the Nisqually Community Forest?
We define it right now. A community forest is a forest that's managed for the benefit of the community of which it's a natural part. So the forest that is around where people are. And a community forest is managed typically, and each forest is and will be unique, but typically managed for a suite of benefits. To provide forestry jobs, provide forestry products, forest products, typically to provide recreation, to provide education, and to provide environmental benefits such as clean water, clean air, protected wildlife habitat. The charge for a community forest is to put together this mix. It is not simply to return profit. Your profit, in fact, is often returned not in dollars, but in more salmon in your streams, more jobs in your community, more kids out in the forest and seeing it and growing up as part of a forest. At the same time, if you're borrowing money, you got to generate money to pay those loans too. So you do have to be able to work as a business. And a community forest, certainly the Nisqually Community Forest, is a working forest. This is not land that is taken out of production, but it's a working forest, as Paula was saying earlier, where we can change the rotations. We know with a fair degree of certainty that about 50 years, a tree is starting to perform a whole lot of functions that are necessary to a healthy system. And if we can lengthen out those rotations, we think we'll see a lot of other benefits in terms of our habitat, our water, our air, and ultimately in terms of the timber we can produce as well.
How large an area will the Nisqually Community Forest cover?
We, and big we, it's our sort of our core committee. We've talked in terms of 20,000 to 30,000 acres being a desirable end goal. We are right now in negotiations for the first 2,000 acres. We have our fingers crossed. A lot of it, this will be with conservation funding that is before the legislature now. But long term, we think 20,000 to 30,000 acres is what we're aiming for.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Joe Kane, Executive Director of the Nisqually Land Trust, and Paula Swedeen, Forest Policy Specialist for the Washington Environmental Council. Our topic is forest protection in Washington State and the Nisqually Community Forest. What are the challenges in establishing the forest?
I would say
money.
And it's also trying to, I wouldn't say exactly create something that hasn't been done before, but to really take the existing models that are out there and adapt them to quite new uses. For example, just learning about what an ownership entity would look like when you go from conservation to a mix of conservation and commercial production in terms of tax structure. What does your ownership entity have to look like? What are your liabilities? If the land trust, as it has been because of just our history, is the lead, how do we minimize risk to the land trust so it can continue to do its work while also giving the community forest the freedom to grow in the way it needs to grow and take the risks it needs to take? So it's a level of expertise and experience and skills that we have to build. And then it's money. Good example, just over a year ago, 100,000 acres on the West Slope owned by a TIMO went up on the market for auction. And everybody who's paying attention to this stuff looked at it and thought, wow, some other TIMO is going to step in. They're going to pay a high dollar for this. We're going to really see forestry accelerated even more on this property. And when the dust settled, the Muckleshoot tribe had bought it. 100,000 acres for $313 million, which was really inspiring in many ways because it was a relocalization of timberland ownership. And it was a very visceral lesson that it's sort of like real estate in San Francisco or even Seattle. If you're here for 5 years, your risk is high. If you're here for 100 years, no matter what you pay now, it's going to feel cheap. And it was a lesson to a lot of folks, including other tribes, that we can all think like timberland owners. No, Muckleshoots have extraordinary economic resources. But it was that first step toward here is a relocalization on a large scale of a commercial forest. And that is valued not just for its commercial timber production, but for many other things as well. It's cultural value, it's environmental value, it's hunting, it's all of these things.
On the financing side, it's not just having enough money, but it's having enough money in time. So one of the challenges that we're going to be dealing with in the lands that are currently owned by a timber investment management organization in our watershed is that they have underlying investors whose needs they need to meet. And parts of the watershed will go up for sale, possibly on short notice. And without us having adequate financing, it can very likely be sold to somebody else. And we would have to wait another period of time in order to be able to acquire it. So trying to get, and I'm going to cross over a little bit into Washington Environmental Council's policy interest in working with the Nisqually Community Forest as a model for other parts of the state, and then how we're thinking about funding forest conservation in general. Many other states in the country have either currently or in the recent past stable pools of funding for the acquisition of working forest conservation easements or other conservation lands. And Washington State has had a different model. We've been very, very good at financing through just regular state bonding mechanisms the acquisition of high conservation value lands. So taking lands where there's really sensitive habitat or there's old growth left or, you know, there's a patch of something for a rare species or that's important from a recreation perspective and taking that land from the private sphere and turning it into public land. And it's been a very popular thing for residents of the state of Washington and it's been very important. I mean, it's accomplished quite a bit. But there's a whole bunch of land that, at least at the moment, may not be identified as having a very unique or special conservation value, but it's important for accomplishing these larger goals. And in the absence of having money that can be spent and allowing that forest to stay in the private sector and to be managed for a combination of conservation and timber products, we're not going to be able to meet the kinds of challenges that the Nisqually watershed is facing and that many other watersheds that feed into the Puget Sound or in other parts of the state are facing. So one of the things that we're looking into is how can we create that pool of funding? So, you know, the governor's climate bill provides a potential opportunity to create a pool of funding. And it makes sense. If you're going to manage private forest lands to increase carbon sequestration, that meets the goals of the state to reduce our emissions and increase livability and increase resilience to the challenges of climate change in the future. And there's many other ways this can be financed. But in the absence of being able to know that there's this pool of funding out there that community forests can apply to, that land trusts can apply to, that private landowners can use in cooperation with land trusts or other entities to be able to change the management, I don't think we're going to be able to keep up with the pace of turnover that we're going to have in our timberlands property market. So back then to the Nisqually Community Forest, we are fortunate to be able to have some salmon-based funding for our first acquisition. But, you know, as Joe said, that money isn't going to pay for everything, and it's just not big enough. So our next acquisition is going to have to be something where we're either financing it through timber harvest, through carbon markets, or if in the next 2 or 3 years we can create these stable funding pools, then we'll be in a better spot.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess I would say it's that I think part of what our job is to educate and to make sure the folks understand how our commercial forests, our private forest lands, largely are now owned, and what globalization of our forest lands means, you know, and that's not to put a value on it. But most folks, I don't think, understand that that's what's happened. A lot of folks, if you talk about it, they think, oh, yeah, Weyerhaeuser owns all that land up there, right? And no, this is no longer the kind of ownership that we have. And that this globalization of our timberlands, the very quick stat that catches most people by surprise, is that about 20% of Pierce County, the entire land mass of Pierce County, is owned by two investment firms on the East Coast. Most folks don't understand that. But the wheel turns, and I think our job is to create and make possible the next step, the post-globalization of our forest lands, which is the relocalization of that ownership. And that's part of our job as a Nisqually Community Forest, is to do the actual work on the ground. It's also to come up with a model that can go out into the world.
I would like listeners maybe take a step back and just to understand the enormous importance of protecting and restoring forest lands to our collective quality of life. And that's true in Washington State. It's true in any place where forest lands exist. But without them, we're in a world of hurt. So it makes a whole lot of sense to spend time and money making sure that we maintain and even restore this resource, because without it, we don't have a chance at dealing with climate change. We have a much better chance of improving local employment, and we have a much better chance of preventing a whole lot of critters from going extinct if we pay attention to and protect our forest estate.
Another good number, one we think about every day, is we now have, last count, we have about 270 Nisqually steelhead trout left. That's it. That's on the planet. And they swim farther, swim higher than any other salmonid in Puget Sound. They depend on that commercial timber zone. If timber practice continues as it has, and there's nothing illegal about it, you know, everybody we work with operates by the regs, it's all clean that way, but we now know that that's not enough. We will lose that species, and we will lose it within a matter of years. This is how species go extinct. It's not all at once, it's incrementally, and then they're gone. And we're right in the middle of it now. And that's where community forestry can play a pivotal role, if we can just make that change in forest practice.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are just listening to Paula Sweden, Forest Policy Specialist for the Washington Environmental Council, and Joe Kane, Executive Director of the Nisqually Land Trust. For more information, check on the web at nisquallylandtrust.org and wecprotects.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.